Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. Thank you for joining us for another live edition of Midrats after a couple of weeks hibernation. We'd like to just say thank you for coming back and join us. I'm here. This is the aforementioned Sal, of course, along with my ever-genial co-host Eagle One of Eagle Speak. We are having our February free-for-all, and you're asking, what does that mean for you? That means in the course of the shows that you've joined us with before, if there's a topic you wish we had addressed but we haven't, and you wanted to bring up that topic, that's a great way to do it, is in the free-for-all. And we have our phones open. We're going to live dangerously here. If you would like to call in and ask us our question directly, you can reach us at area code 347-308-8397, 347-308-8397. And if you're joining us there on the show page, you'll see the number right up there at the top in case you didn't have a pen handy. Also on the show page, if you wanted to scroll down to the bottom because you are self-conscious about your voice, but you still wanted to ask a question, that's where you will find the chat room where you have the usual suspect lines up. And if you don't have a question, but you have a point of order you would like to bring up during the course of the show, that's a great place to do it because we'll be monitoring that as the show goes forward. And without further ado, introduction or delay, Eagle One, welcome back from vacation.
Oh, thank you, Sal. You too. In fact, given how long it took you to get the show page up today, your vacation was longer than mine.
Thank you. No mercy, no quarter asked, none given. Yes, I was. What did we learn in the 1990s? Just in time. Wouldn't that be just a very efficient show page building? I think PQL, PQS book signed off just for doing that the way I did.
Reminds me of one of my son's Eagle Project, just in time.
Yeah, all you kiddies out there may not have gone through TQL, but how about let's not do a show and say we did on it? Best to be behind us. Speaking of things that are behind us and going back into the past, just to kick off the show today, I wanted to ask the question, being that I will never be the commander-in-chief, and everybody likes to use a cliche, this is a question that the commander-in-chief likes to say, but in the news the last week was the fact that we have struck Libya again. We've hit some of the ISIS training camps there, and of course, everybody complains about U.S. inaction, U.S. leadership. Part of the reason is every time we do it, somebody's got some complaint. It appears that there were a couple of Serbian hostages that were killed during the attack. And, of course, everybody's saying it was a horrible mistake, and they wonder why we don't do more things. Again, unfortunate for the family of those killed, but these things happen in war. But when I was reading up on it, and from what I've seen in open source, is a strike was taking place using the replacement for what, when Reagan hit Libya back in the 80s, El Dorado Canyon. The one critique of it was that the Air Force wedged their foot in the door and they flew the great F-111 from Lakenheath all the way over to the Mediterranean to strike things right on the coast. And it appears that the replacement for the F-111, the F-18E, was the one that was used in this. And I've looked, but I have not seen Eagle One anywhere where somebody can say, where is the carrier? Is this almost a good talking point in the carrier battles that continues to go on? Because, back in the day, the 6th Fleet always had a carrier in the area just for these types of things. Because the bad thing about land-based air is if the host nation goes, yeah, not so much, you're pretty much out of luck. Have you seen anything, Eagle One, bringing up the fact that we're We're long hauling from Old Blighty. Things are just a few nautical miles from shore.
No, I haven't seen anything, but I'm not surprised because most people don't seem appear. Many people who comment on even on military affairs don't seem to remember that we have carriers. There's also the question of, I mean, I think you've met, didn't they use Strike Eagle F-15Es instead of the...
Correct.
Okay, I thought you said F-18. So...
I may have. My condolences. No, it was the F-18 yeah. Strike Eagle. You know, the teenagers, 15, 18, who can tell the difference nowadays?
Yeah, I guess it's because we sent all our F-22s for an impressive air show to impress North Korea. But, you know, I would gather that since we flew the F-15s, somebody must have given us permission to launch. Somebody must have known. We must have gotten diplomatic clearance somewhere. The biggest protests I've seen have been from, not too surprisingly, one of the Russian networks has said, you know, the question of Libyan sovereignty, which I think was mooted several months ago when the first time we got together and ganged up and attacked Libya. So... I have not heard anybody complain about the lack of carriers, but I, for one, am pleased to see the Air Force getting involved. They do have aircraft that have the legs to do this sort of thing. So it allows us to operate with fewer carriers or the number of carriers we actually have, and that can't necessarily be a bad thing. What about you?
No, No, and it's kind of interesting. The F-15, you got my brain there, shipmate. The F-15E really is an incredible aircraft. And there was an interesting write-up a while back of the genesis of the Strike Eagle was validated by the Israelis, ironically, using the classic Israeli, you know, one hand full of duct tape, the other one with baling wire, let me make something work. They use some of their two-seater F-15s to strike Libya, of all things, all the way from Israel. It really is, especially the latest iteration of it, it really is an incredible aircraft. But you're right, it is good to see the Air Force getting in the game a bit more. I think it further emphasizes the fact that there is value in maintaining these base agreements. We don't have very many overseas bases left compared to what we did a quarter century ago. And there is a valid argument to pulling back further, but there does reach a point that if something does need to be done, who can do it? I think the unfortunate answer is it devolves to the U.S. Who has the ability to do long-range strike to defend the interests of the West, for lack of a better phrase? In theory, the Brits might be able to pull it off, but they're probably one or two not mission-capable TriStar tankers away from not being able to do it because they have some Tornadoes that can do it. There are other nations that, in theory, have the ability to do it, but won't for political reasons. And it needs to be done. And as we are at a economy of force, I think is the polite way of putting it, what would logically be a naval operation, and who knows, and I don't want to know, and it's none of our business to know, the chain of events that led up to the intel that gave us the ability to strike, there may very well not have been time to move whatever carrier asset was nearby to go take care of business. Whereas if you have long range strike and the ability to have enough in place, you can put a package together from range, you can do that. But nobody else can do that in the Mediterranean. Well, the Russians can, but they're not too big on precision attack, which is one of the things that, you know, I noticed in the last few days is here we do a clear strike against clear bad guys. And the press of our allies are already picking at us because a few non-targeted individuals were killed, like always happens in war. But the Russians, as we've all seen in the video, have their backfire bombers at 30,000 plus feet, dropping dumb bombs all over creation and back. And you hear maybe a whine or two. But I guess that's just the nature of the beast, where we're held to a higher standard. It does open the door to an interesting concept, though. The Russians have moved back, at least into the eastern Mediterranean, with a steady naval presence. We saw the old Cold Warrior, the Sava-class cruiser off the coast, but they have the smaller ships that are also armed with that caliber land attack cruise missile. If they're going to reopen that, and it is a free fire zone against ISIS targets in the Mediterranean periphery, Libya, there is the Institute for the Study of War, which, if you don't follow them on Twitter, in addition to Eagle One and myself on Twitter, you really should. They've got some great maps. They had a recent map that broke out Libya, the quasi-government held territory, ISIS held territory, and other Islamic radicals holding territory. I guess there is really, if you were looking for a classic failed state, a Mad Max state, Libya would be it. You know, is who decides who can enter that airspace and who can enter the territorial waters when there is no government that really has control over that entire body of water?
Yeah, it's a great question. And the answer that we used in Somalia for the Somali pirates was we went to the UN and essentially got a declaration that Somalia was a failed state and that the UN gave permission for counter-piracy forces to enter Somali waters and enforce various UN resolutions against piracy. I don't know what we're operating under in Libya. I think, as I recall, that one of the issues before was with the El Dorado Canyon was the French wouldn't give us permission to fly over France. I'm not sure Spain would give permission to fly over Spain, so that they had to go with carrier air, because originally the plan might originally been to fly directly out of England, and the only ones that could make it were the F-111s. But not real sure. Hugh and I were talking a little bit before the show started about, you know, what's the most basic question that I would ask in these days. And I would say we've got, it's a presidential election year. Thank goodness I don't watch any of the stuff on TV, because what I read in the paper and online is enough disturbing enough. But the question I was going to pose was, and this leads to everything else we're going to talk about today, I think, is 7 years after we've elected President Obama, is, in your mind, the world a safer place now that we have a Nobel Peace Prize winning president in office?
Well, let's walk around the neighborhood and see where we are. When the president took power, the surge was 1 year after its defined success. Most people said victory was roughly obtained in the fall of 2008, right before the election in Iraq, as long as we had enough there to sustain it. And it was decided at that point that actually, no. And there was a real interesting interview. I know they can be problematic on a few issues like global warming, but when it comes to the long war, Vice has done some very good reporting. And they were, I cannot recall his name, but he was a young man, young, 30, 35, maybe 40 at the most, man, American, of Arabic extraction, who advised three ambassadors over two different administrations in Iraq. And he brought up a very good point. The two big things that happened in Iraq was the precipitous run to zero for forces in western Iraq, which created the conditions to allow the Alawi government to continue their sectarian actions and to have the Sunnis open their doors, but also brought up a point that I knew and had just filed away, and it had come out of my calculus. It was right on. If you recall, in 2010, there was an election in Iraq where Elahi didn't technically win the election, but because of parliamentary procedures and maneuvers, who was the gentleman who should have won, was pushed to the side and pushed to the back. He was a secularizer, non-sectarian, and that kind of followed the ball rolling there. So he was fair in saying that there are two big mistakes in Iraq. He said, one, the 2003 invasion and backing Elahi in the 2010 election, which is a very good point. Iraq, I think we can put that into the not better environment. Afghanistan, I think you're familiar with my arguments on this. We actually had momentum going when we took back after NATO culminated in 2007 and just wasn't going to be able to do what it needed to do. We started taking the keys back in 2008. McKernan had shaped clear hold build in there. It was a long-range district-by-district conditions-based program. And in December 2009, that was all thrown away and went to calendar-based. There's been some backing up on that. Afghanistan, now the Taliban has not only moved into districts it'd never been in before, the Islamic State's actually there. If you wanted to be charitable, you could call Afghanistan a wash, from a green up arrow to a yellow side arrow, if you wanted to be charitable. When you go out to Europe, well, I think all you have to do is look at what is happening in Eastern Europe. Crimea is gone. You've got the southeastern region of Ukraine is under Russian occupation. The Balts are concerned. The Central Europeans, what do they call it, the Visegrad group of the Poles, the Czechs, the Slovaks, the Hungarians, right down the center part. I think what's been interesting is the migrant crisis, which is a direct result of the failures in Iraq and Syria. We'll talk about, I'll give you my take on Syria here in a second, is putting a wedge through the former Warsaw Pact nations and former Soviet states who are now independent and part of NATO, and Western Europeans. The Central Europeans are not playing games when it comes to the invasion of hundreds of thousands of military-aged, unassimilable, unemployable men. And you combine that in Europe with the Russian prodding and tickling on the East, Europe's been destabilized to a huge degree. And there's many more cards out of that deck that need to be played. Syria went from being a page B3 story to a page A1 story. There were opportunities early on to make some other decisions, but in what is, I think history will judge as some of the hallmarks of the national security team with this administration, the level of dithering and delay. Things took their course, and it's been beyond our control to the point that we no longer want to have any control of it, which I think is fair. You go out to the Pacific, though. If you ignore the sandcastles in the South China Sea that maybe we'll talk about later on in the show, American dithering and our sense of weakness, I think, has actually had a positive secondary effect, in that we have the Japanese are standing a little firmer. You have the Filipinos and the Australians and the Vietnamese are communicating better. So there is some sense of at least the peripheral nations standing up a little more. But as a side note, Korea continues to be, the Northern Korea continues to be North Korea, though I don't think you can put any of that blame on the present administration. North Korea has been given the raspberry to every administration since the armistice was signed in the 1950s. So no big change there. Are we safer and more secure? Everything I just talked about, though, isn't the most important thing in my mind. We're $19 trillion in debt. We're going on $20 trillion. The world is awash in debt. There are nations who are worse than we are. But we have left a legacy for our children and our grandchildren that, as a result, they will not have the flexibility to address the challenges that they'll be faced in 10, 20, 30, 40 years that we and previous generations have had, because there's a lot of ruin in a nation, as the cliche goes. There is a lot that a nation can draw on and can mortgage in order to address challenges. But as a lot of people found out personally in 2008 and 2009, when the going is good or okay and you're already mortgaged to the hilt, what happens when things go south? What capital and collateral do you have to draw on to borrow from the future in order to address a hard spot? The answer is you can't, and bad things happen. What happens when that happens on a national scale? There's plenty of examples from history, and none of them are too encouraging. So the debt we've accumulated in the last 7 years is, in the long run, what worries me the most.
Yeah, I would be more worried about the debt, I guess, if we hadn't achieved a certain level of energy independence, which, although this administration has totally discouraged it, could enable the U.S. to not, incur debt to fund some, we actually should be selling more of our oil and gas and coal resources instead of trying to find ways to turn us into the greenest nation on the face of the earth. But, I kind of look at what's going on with some of the entitlements that we have. Is if you picture a python that swallowed a pig, we've got my generation, the baby boomers, sitting in the middle of that python right now, choking the thing. But on the other end of it, there's a much narrower. It should get better. I mean, we've the Social Security mess and all that could get better if we address it now, so that the future generations, yours and my son's and my daughter's generation, will be able to look forward to some kind of benefit there. And if we don't continue to do foolish things, which is borrow money to pay for, I'm not really sure what we're paying for anymore, to pay for people's entitlements, we just can't continue that. So I agree with you, but I do see at least one ray of sunshine in there, in that we are totally capable of being energy independent if we so choose.
That's a very good point, is that energy independence. Because of my academic background, I like to spend half my time with Miss Mary Sunshine, and then I like to spend time with the very, very grumpy, dark, depressed person in the corner who the perma bears are always interesting, because like broken clocks, they're right a few times. Because if you just consume popular economic media, you're mostly getting Miss Mary Sunshine. You don't usually get the people that are reminding you about the rust underneath the bumper that's been painted over three times. But they brought on a very good point that you got to keep an eye on the Saudis and the petrodollar. And this guy, he's not a gold bug either, which was interesting. But he pulled it back to when, in 1973, Nixon closed the gold door. That was done in conjunction with agreements that were made with the Saudis and the petrodollar. Dollar being the primary currency for the trade in petroleum. And the Saudis are following their own Shefin plan with a two-front war, it appears, if they actually put forces in number in Syria. But anyway, the Saudis, who have over half of their I think it's between 60 and 70% of the population is under 30. Most people actually work for the government. If things get too touchy for them, they may start asking people to start paying in gold if they want to buy oil, because they're losing confidence in the dollar. The one good thing about that is if things get that bad, we actually can't produce enough fuel, especially at a higher per unit volume here. We do have additional security if things really go to pot. And the world does go to pot on a quasi-regular basis every century or so. So when that eventuality comes, you're right. We do have enough internally here to keep things humming if need be. So, energy independence is a good thing.
I was reading a piece in the Oil and Gas Journal, going back to my roots in that industry, some professor from Yale University was talking about Russia, and it's been able to, despite the fact that we think that by putting more oil and gas into the, which is a fungible good, into the world system, Russia's been able to ride this out a lot better than many people thought. Many people thought by putting more oil out there, having crude oil prices drop, we could starve Russia a little bit on their ability to produce more aircraft and engage in these out of territory exercises, such as in Ukraine and Syria. This guy says that he doesn't think that's the case because the Russian government has actually planned around that and adopted some different financial strategies which allow them to kind of weather this thing. And it's an interesting point of view that using oil as a weapon, as we used to worry about, it doesn't seem to be working too well for us when we try and apply it against the Russians.
Yeah, what did Fred Thompson's character in The Hunt for Red October say? Russians don't take a crap without a plan. I would be very surprised if Russia was doing any of this without thoroughly planning it out with a variety of branch plans in place. I don't think they're making it up as they go along. That's just not their style. And I think also it would be really interested in 40 or 50 years, as somebody who hasn't assumed room temperature yet gets a chance to look at their planning documents, that they've been pretty darn successful using the economy of force that they've wanted to do. If you step back and think like a Russian, what they've been able to accomplish, especially in their ongoing info ops and psyops war against Europe and Ukraine, Crimea, Syria, the facts on the ground speak for themselves. They're doing a pretty disciplined, I wouldn't say predictable, but a pretty logical, the geography there dictates what it does, pretty logical plan in Syria to secure the Assad regime and make it a fait accompli where you either are supporting Assad and Russia or you're supporting the Islamic State. Pick your poison. And they've been pushing and trending in that direction. I think 2016 will be an interesting way to develop what's going to happen by midsummer as they continue to invest Aleppo. Once Aleppo is completely theirs, they're going to be able to pinch off that little corner of resistance to the northwest, clean up their lines facing the Islamic State. The Kurds are nibbling around and cleaning up their lines as well. The interesting thing, we'll see what we do on the Iraq side of the equation. Who's the hammer, who's the anvil, I don't know. But it's the middle of an election year, so I don't think we're going to do anything drastic. And speaking of election years, I kind of touched on this during the pre-show, but I just want to roll it out there. A couple of folks in the chat room may have seen something, or maybe somebody wants to call in and tell us what's going on. But there is a non-zero chance that by the end of spring, we will have a Trump v. Sanders general election. And one thing that I've noticed for both of these individuals. I can't find out who their national security team is. There was actually an interesting article out where I thought it was unfortunate. They interviewed some of the traditional Democrat foreign policy shops, and it was almost like being in middle school again. They're going, well, when he was senator, he never reached out to us, so we're not talking to him. And most of them have already been bought into Hillary. But if there is a non-zero chance, not that Sanders is going to win every primary, but that Mrs. Clinton is going to find herself indicted by the FBI. If that takes place, she's not running in the general. Or she does, and you know she loses 48 states, or nobody votes for anybody. But the odds are greater than non-zero that Trump, on the Republican side, will win. And I've talked to a few people in the D.C. environs who play in these circles, asking around, you know, who is advising Trump? And the answer is they don't know. So if you have two people who don't have a cadre of national security experts trolling in behind them, whether you like to or not, when you're president of the U.S., you have some huge responsibilities. Am I too concerned about this, or will it all work out in the end?
Yeah, there's a great question for you. I don't think you can be too concerned. Is it possibly too concerned about a couple of morons becoming president of the United States? I want to say something nice about people who continue to be socialists and who deny the reality of what happened in every socialist state in history, but I can't think of too much to say except they just don't seem to recognize reality when it smacks them in the face.
Yeah,
so,
either that, or they think, like most socialists, well, that's just the cost that you pay to get the society you want. Yeah, I feel the same way as you do. In 2016, if you're a socialist, you got to go pray on a few things. I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, last I heard of Venezuela, they just weren't really loving this exciting socialist economy stuff that they had, but you know, that could just be me. You know, I was Trump is a difficult question. My problem is that I keep reading these papers. You know, Trump sweeps South Carolina. Well, he got 33% of the vote. But if you combine Cruz and Rubio, they outdid him at the polls collectively, not individually. So that would indicate to me that a majority of the people who are casting votes in the primaries aren't really voting for Trump. They're voting for anybody but Trump. And, you know, I think the Republicans have hurt themselves by having too many people, and I hate to say this, but too many people running for office who should never have been in there. You know, I think they're I don't know who the grown-ups are supposed to be running this party, if there are such people, whether Trump is just such a wild card that it doesn't matter who's in, you know, who's running the party. He's going to do whatever Trump wants. But, you know, the majority of people have been casting ballots in all the, I think in all the primaries I've seen so far, that's what, three or four. He's not getting the majority of the votes. So, and, you know, and of course, the Republicans don't have this, to add insult to injury, the Republicans don't have the same system the Democrats have with this super delegate thing, where Hillary loses primaries to Sanders, but ends up with more delegates to the convention. I'm fascinated by how the Democrats have done this themselves. I'm fascinated by Trump's approach to politics, but you know, sometimes I feel like I'm watching a live version of Idiocracy. It's not a pleasant feeling.
Yeah, nobody said it was supposed to be a documentary. I will say this for the Democrat Party, though, and you made me think of it when you mentioned their superdelegates. Like good socialists, you have to respect their party discipline. Say what you want to about Debbie Wasserman Schultz, besides the fact that you're glad you're not married to her. But They know what they want. They want Hillary as a nominee. They've cleared the deck. They've got the money. They've got the structure. They've got the organization. They've already tied up the national security shop, the economic shop. They've been very, very disciplined. Sanders was an independent. He's running in the Democrat primary. O'Malley, say no more. I was very disappointed, but I want to toot my horn here for a second. Remember when James Webb announced that he was running for Democrat? And I put some stuff out there. I said, he's only going to break your heart. He's a serial quitter. He quits all the time. And of course he did. But the Democrat side has just been a disappointment in many ways, that they really haven't given the American people a good choice in case the Republicans totally screw things up. I think Reince Priebus, who shouldn't have been given another term, but he was, I think after this is all done, he really needs to go away. I am very disappointed in the Democrats. There are some very good Democrats out there. I may not agree with a lot of their policies, but they know their trade. They have a reasonable view of how things work. They aren't being investigated by the FBI, and would make a fine chief executive. There are some out there, but the party discipline kept them out of the equation, and that's where domestic politics really does become a national security issue. The world looks to us, for better or worse, because there really are no other options when things get wobbly. I've had to counsel personally, and I've been snarky about it in my writing occasionally with my European friends who complain. I say, hey, listen, y'all are the ones that gave him the preliminary Nobel Prize. And the American people have voted for this twice in no small measure because everybody seemed in the world think it was a great idea. This is America you wanted. This is the American policy that the American people voted for twice. This is what you got. You've got to deal with it. And I look at who the likely candidates are on both parties, and it's combine the what at least I believe I know what's coming on in the economy with this lack of serious managerial experience. That looks like it's going to win. It's going to be a challenging regardless of who wins. There are some candidates that I think would make fine chief executives, but you can't finish second and third in every contest and be a viable candidate. So it's going to be interesting. My lovely wife asked me, does she have the option to vote for nobody? I said, no, you got to pick whatever chalice of poison you want to and vote for.
Well, I was overlooking at the, and if you think this is a mess, you got to see the Libertarian Party. They've got like 12 candidates, one of whom is a former governor of New Mexico, who did at one point run as a Republican, I think, for something. I can't remember. The problem is, if you're choosing between Sanders, who, as you have said, has no executive experience at all in anything. In fact, I'm not sure what he did before he got elected to office, but I don't think it was anything particularly notable. And Mrs. Clinton, who, it's a good thing that Pinocchio is not reality. She would not ever be able to get through any door. Truth seems to be, and there was a brilliant article, I can't remember, it might have been Victor David Hansen who wrote it, but talking about her serial lying, she cannot stop lying about stuff that is inconsequential. I mean, some of it's inconsequential, some of it's very consequential, but her statement that she was named after Sedgwick Hillary, certainly not true. I mean, just little tiny stuff that builds up and you just go on and on with this. So what, you know, how can you support that, especially when the lies get more and more important? I never received an email with a classification on it. Well, if you tell people not to, to make sure they cut out the classification, no, you might not have ever received one with a classification. Does that mean you didn't know it was classified? You know, I mean, I just don't understand.
I think anybody who has any type of military background is the same. Well, I mean, let me ask you this, Captain. If you had been taking stuff out of the skiff and putting it on a thumb drive and taking it home and putting it on your Compaq or your Dell or your Apple and emailing it to your old NROTC buddy living in Santa Barbara, you might have some issues there, shipmate. I know if I had done anything like that. I mean, I've been in an office where you have a green, a red, an orange, and a yellow computer, and you're always putting stickers on crap because we make sure that you don't have one go to the other one. So I think we've talked about this before. If the FBI gives her a pass on this, you know.
No, then there is no law.
There's no law.
Yeah, I mean, I've been a lawyer for a long time. I've been a person sworn to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States for a long time. But if people get away with violating these laws like this, there is no law. That you might as well just say it's all totally relative to who you are and. Power allows you to escape things that most other people would have been put in jail for exceptionally long periods of time for. And let's go back and look at Scooter Libby and the theoretical outing of what's her name, Plame.
Valerie.
You know, how in the world, he didn't even do it. He got time in jail. And the guy who did do it, as far as I know, and this is, you know, he who was Republican administration, I think, at the time, but the guy who did, who did out her, never got punished for anything, as far as I know. That, you know, this is just outrageous. It's outrageous on a lot of counts.
The only thing that protects Armistead is the fact that he was a right-hand man of Powell, who people refused to lay a hand on. But that's maybe a different topic for a different day, but that guy.
Yeah.
That guy, as the kids say. Hey, before you drive me to start drinking before 6 p.m., trying to avoid the day drinking at all possible costs.
It's always 5 o'clock somewhere.
Yes, sir. Well, let me bring up something that at least I think is a good news story. There was lots of gnashing of teeth and rending of clothes, but I kind of went, hey, Navy did a smart one. Yay. That was, and God bless them. Or as we Southerners say, bless their heart. But when it comes to unmanned air systems, people have been watching way too much science fiction movies. And in the course of the last few years, as the classified material, you know what I'm talking about, the unmanned air system was coming along, people talking about, well, you know, they're not subjected to G-forces. So totally, and you'll appreciate this, Counselor, totally ignoring ROE, or anything like that. They go, oh, yeah, they could have computer programs. They could down any manned fighter. They could go in and they could do close interdiction. You know, it's like, no, time out, shipmate. We're way far away from having, you know, Terminator with wings going on here. But when they decided what they're going to do with the system, which they're now going to call CBARS, which that's as good an acronym as any, though I wish they would just give it a proper name.
Carrier-based air refueling system.
Yes, CBARS.
CBARS.
That they said, you know what, unmanned system, and we've talked about it here on Midraps with Midraps. Midraps is a type of burrito, I think. Anyway, on Midraps, we've talked with some of our guests that one of the glaring holes that we have in naval air is range and organic tankers. So whoever made this argument, I owe him a good bottle of scotch. They said, hey, we can't buddy tank forever. We need tanking capability. The software for tanking is probably doable for an unmanned system. Give me a 100-pound head to tell me how much fuel this can carry. Let's do that, and then let's see what's going on. I think that was a beautiful idea for a variety of ways. One, it'll help get us away from buddy tanking, which takes out a strike asset. It'll get carriers an opportunity to get experience working with manned systems. The software people, even though they will overpromise and underdeliver, will have less of a hurdle to jump through to get there, and we'll learn some stuff on a pretty baseline mission before we go to the Terminator with wings situation. Be interesting to see how it works, how the people of Pax River make it work. But I thought that was one. When you look at the history of the last couple of decades of all the transformationalists. Experiments gone awry here, that this looked like a pretty sound and good decision on my part. What are your thoughts? Did they lowball it or to be determined?
No, I the first thing is that the UCAS or whatever it is, CBARS, it's a big aircraft. It's not a little tiny Scan Eagle drone. You know, it's a big airplane. And I can see huge advantages in this. And the only, I'm not sure I want to be the first F-18 guy to hook up with this thing, but I assume by the time we make that work that we'll have enough experience and the fleet guys it won't bother them at all. But I see huge advantages. You could put three of these things up simultaneously. I mean, or two or three of them, and you've got multiple tanking capacity out there then. Without crew fatigue, without all those other things go along with manned aircraft stuff, and you can cycle them. You know, one gets empty, you just send it back, and then it refills and comes back out. There's no downtime for crew rest and all that stuff. I think it's a really good idea. I think that anything. I think that eventually we're going to see a pretty good mix of manned aircraft and unmanned craft out there operating together. I think this is a good chance to start working, as you just said, work out the bumps in that. And it's a fairly low, if anything, it'd be low risk in naval aviation. It's a pretty low risk aviation endeavor and has the potential to really help us, as you said, fill that gap in our space and that without a great deal of additional cost. Because they don't have all the personnel habitability stuff, these things can be much more efficient and much less expensive than some kind of tanker system that we would have that had manned.
Yeah, I'll be really interested in seeing what their per unit cost is as well. And I know there's some romanticism about bringing the S3 back, and I've seen the numbers to do it. But you've got, I hate to say it, but you've got Millington-centric issues involved with that. You know, career paths, standing up squadrons, yada yada yada.
We just killed a whole strike wing, I think, to save money.
You did.
I can't imagine that they're gonna jump up and down and go, oh boy, let's bring some S3s back. We need a whole new squadron for that.
and we need to learn how to take unmanned systems to the next level. I think the logical progression is let's spend a few years deploying at these things. Then we probably using the same bloody platform or 80% commonality of it. Let's put up an ISR version, then maybe we can go to the recallable TLAM attack version, and then we can go to. But this is a multi-decade operation, as it should be, because there is something about a man in the loop and connectivity and the whole nine yards. If you're going to go beyond what we're doing with TLAM, that's quite a learning curve. Let's crawl, walk, run. So I think it's a pretty nice crawl. So tell me, and things bouncing around your noggin, have you had any anything that made you sit back and go, smart?
Well, I'm in love with this. I go back to something we've already discussed briefly in previous shows, but this distributed lethality program that the Navy's undertaken to spread weapons onto, and to, I hope, to upgrade, upgun some of our existing platforms and make the whole Navy weaponized as opposed to surrendering certain units and saying, well, you know, we just can't let them get near combat. So I'm a fan of that program. It's a big surface warfare thing, and being a surface warfare guy, of course, I like it. I also like the concept. I think that's smart. I think that's a good use of our dollars. It's pretty easy. I can't imagine it's that hard to upgun something like an LCS. I mean, I know that there's a whole new version coming out, vertical launch, blah blah blah. But you know, everybody else in the world is using boxes. I don't understand why we're not just using box launchers until we get where we're going. You know, we're satisfied we've got the right answer as far as some of these other platforms go. But I can't imagine that we're so dumb we can't make boxes work like an OSA 3, whatever that is, OSA 2, you know, can carry some kind of surface to surface missile, and we have to act like we can't. I don't get it myself. I did see a disturbing story the other day that the Russians are putting on some of their cruisers these hyper speed anti-ship missiles. That's a little concerning to me, but I assume somewhere somebody brighter than I am has got the magic answer to that. But
yeah,
anyway.
That's the Russians have always had, especially at the tail end of the Soviet Union, they developed some anti-ship cruise missiles that really made you stand up and pay attention. Even us liberal arts guys that were forced to take physics, remember F equals MA, and we know what an exocet can do, or even a harpoon can do to a modern warship, even when its warhead doesn't explode. You have something coming in at Mach 3 plus, it doesn't have to go boom, it just needs to hit it, and everything is coming to a full stop. But it's a challenge that you hope you never have to face at sea, but as usual, the Russians will find a way to distribute that lethality to other nations. So we do need to have a way to counter that. And I like what you talked about, the whole concept of distributed lethality. I think I know I sound like a press release, but it was a logical take of the, you know, CNOs going from the roughhead diversity is my number one priority to the warfighting first. Okay, how do we warfight? Where are some of the things we need to do better at? And part of it was the dirty little secret. Most of our Arleigh Burkes don't have any anti-ship capability at all. They can't carry harpoon. We have that new modernized anti-ship missile in development. It'll be great to see it go through training, and let's just assume that it works out just dandy. The announcement that the SM-6 will have an anti-surface capability, I think, is also great. The SM-1 had a very good operational history as an anti-ship missile, mostly against the Iranians. But that's okay. It was a good live fire exercise. It validated the concept. So that will give everybody that carries that SM-6 that capability again, once it gets through the testing. But the thing I like about distributed lethality the best is it returns to a fundamental of naval warfare that we walked away from, that people thought they had it all figured out, you didn't have to do it anymore, or were hedging their bets and absorbing risk, walked away from. I was thought back to World War II. There was a move to towards, I think it was mid-43, on the DEs, your regular destroyers carried two banks of torpedoes. The DEs carried one. One five pack, I think it was. Anyway, five or four. There was a move to take those off of the DEs and to replace it with more anti-aircraft guns. And the big pushback from the community was no. It's like one day these little DEs are going to be asked to fight with the big boys because we're the only ones that are going to be there, and we need a weapon to fight with the big boys with, and that's the torpedo. And you look at Taffy 3 and everything else. That was every ship out there. You need to have the ability that when something comes across the horizon, that every ship there has the ability to engage that target, be it in the air, be it on the surface, or you're making a high-speed run in the Haiphong Harbor. Everybody there needs to be able to send ordnance downrange. And getting back to distributed lethality gives us that capability where, yeah, Unit X might have twice the capability of Unit Y, but we have three times of Unit Y, so that's okay. It's better to have three times 0.5 than zero, so we'll run with that. So I think it's good. It'll be nice to see when we get the SM-6 out in numbers, when we get the replacement for the Harpoon out there in numbers. Of course, I would like to take my hobby horse out of the stable, put a harness on her, and it at least parade her around the campground for a little bit, and that would be our anti-submarine capability, our lightweight torpedoes. No reason to go into it further, but number and quantity is an issue. Plus, there is the fact that it's very dumb, and I'll use that word, it's dumb to go to war with only one weapon. And right now, if we need to kill a submarine, and we're not a submarine, all we have is a lightweight torpedo. That's dumb. The Swedes have learned that. Everybody who's actually tried to kill submarines learned that over and over again. I would hope that as we go towards distributed lethality and we have more than one capability to attack ships, that once again we will look with a clear, cold eye and say, we need more than one way to kill a submarine. So that's what I would like to see come out at the other end of distributed lethality. But if my economist friend is right, then we're not going to have the money to do it. So yeah.
Well, I'm really impressed by the efforts of DARPA and the Office of Naval Research with some of these autonomous anti-submarine vessels they're coming up with, and some of these other undersea UUVs, undersea unmanned. A lot of missions, many missions, and enhance. What's the word? They plus up our capabilities significantly. It's a force enhancer, and something that the U.S. ought to be leading, and I hope is leading the world in developing these things. But that's exactly where. Lee, I see your note. They dream up a lot about vessels. They don't all work, but if half of them work, if a third of them work, but they do their job well, God bless them. As a guy, you don't want to be the guy out there trying to depend on technology that's 30 years old. If you can have something that has some chance, it's kind of like the 3-point shot in basketball. If you shoot 30%, that's a really good number. So 70% of the time you miss, but even so, you can win a lot of ball games shooting 30%. And that's kind of the way I look at some of these high tech things that ONR and DARPA come up with.
And that's one thing I would always like to see, but again, I'm not in for these things don't take place. You mentioned 30 years. One thing that we've been bad about is we don't do iterative developments pretty well. I don't see an issue where you have 30-year-old technology in the fleet, you have 15-year-old technology in the fleet, you have 5-year-old technology in the fleet, and you're working on something else. This, we've tried so hard to skip generations that if we have a development failure, then we skip two generations and we're fighting with 30-year-old equipment. But you're right. We got smart people doing hard work. If they can just get the right direction and guidance and the right leadership and a little bit of money to do it, I think it'll work out really well. Hey, we're coming to the end of the show. And I just wanted to remind everybody, next week, we got returning guest Toshi Yosahara. We're going to talk about the goings-on in Westpac. And then we are going to have on 6 March, Corey Dauber. What are the subjects we're going to be talking with Corey about there, Eagle One?
Well, she's had a number of papers on how ISIS is using social media to promote themselves, and so we're going to be talking to her along those lines about the use of modern social media by some of these organizations. We'd rather not be involved in that.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. That's a topic that we haven't really addressed directly. We'll have a full hour, so that's going to be really productive. Well, hey, our hour is complete. Another fast and furious free-for-all. Eagle One, as always, a pleasure to talk to you. Most of our listeners, they miss out on the fact, and we've mentioned it before, but at the end of the show, we usually talk for a bit, and we go, we should just record that sometime. So it was a good opportunity to let our guests hear some of the things we talk about when the show's over.
Yeah, I enjoyed it, and look forward to our guests the next couple of weeks, too. So here we go.
Here we go. And thank you very much, everybody, for joining us for another edition of Midrats. Do join us next week when our guest is Toshi Yoshihara from the Naval War College. Until then, have a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way to Tipperary.
Pete Rose logged more hits in baseball history than anyone else. No one has come close to breaking his record. But he was also at the center of one of the game's biggest scandals, a scandal that changed baseball forever. In the new book, Charlie Hustle, New York Times bestselling author Keith O'Brien chronicles Pete Rose's spectacular rise and fall. Drawing on firsthand interviews with Rose himself and his associates, this is Pete Rose as we've never seen him before. By Charlie Hustle, available wherever books are sold.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.